Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Many of our most important social and political debates have science at their core. Think climate change or genetically modified foods. When policymakers want expert input on these subjects, they often turn to massive synthesis reports known as assessments. Putting one of these together can take years of work by dozens or even hundreds of scientists. And yet, this practice has become so common that the National Research Council alone publishes more than 200 such assessment reports each year. Now, a new book explores the origins of modern scientific assessments and asks whether all these reports are actually doing what we think they are. Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science at Harvard University and co-author of Discerning Experts, The Practice of Scientific Assessment for Environmental Policy. Naomi, always great to have you on the show.
Thanks. Great to be back with you, Heather.
Okay, so these expert panels creating these big synthesis reports, I mean, that's really the norm now. We're all familiar with, I think, particularly the climate assessments, whether it's the National Climate Assessment or the UN's, you know, international panel that comes out with a report every few years. But of course, this hasn't always been the case. Where did the modern scientific assessment come from?
Well, what we showed in our book was that there's a long history of society reaching out to experts for opinion on these important kinds of questions. And actually, we begin the book with a discussion of spirit discernment in the Middle Ages. So there were actually expert panels of bishops and priests who were called upon to judge whether or not a person was possessed by the devil. So there's a very long tradition. And so one of the questions we wanted to answer was, how is what's going on now different than what may have happened in the past? And what we showed in the book was that although we could identify earlier forms of activities that we could call assessments of a certain sort, the modern assessment is really a post-World War II phenomenon. And it has to do with two things. One is the growth of science itself, that particularly in the United States and Western Europe, science grew dramatically after World War II. So you just have a lot more scientists doing a lot more work. And that makes it harder for government officials, policymakers to discern what the scientific literature has to say. And then you have the emergence of specific kinds of questions, like you mentioned, climate change, where there's a particular question that has obvious policy relevance. Policymakers need some mechanism to sort through all this different science. And so the assessment emerges as an institutionally sanctioned way to do that.
With some of these questions, and climate change is a great example, where a scientific issue or an issue that has a science component to it becomes really polarized and divisive within the political realm. Is that part of what drove the rise of these panels and big reports, as opposed to maybe a president just turning to a science advisor for advice on a particular issue?
We didn't look specifically at the question of why government officials want assessments. And what we were really trying to get at was, what is an assessment? What are scientists doing? What kind of knowledge do they produce? And how should we as citizens understand that knowledge? So our focus is, we could say, internal to the scientific community. But we do talk a bit in the book about the historical origins. And as you said, one of the things that we can see is that there is an earlier period in which a president or a senator might just turn to scientists they know and ask them a question. And we certainly see this in the archives. I've found letters in the archives where senators wrote to Roger Revelle back in the 1960s and 70s and 80s asking his opinion about climate change. But certainly there's the feeling that begins to emerge, and we see this in the historical record, that it's not really enough just to ask a person, an individual scientist, no matter how smart or good that scientist might be, that there's a need for something that's more structured, that's more organized, that's more systematic, and also, and this is a big part of the story, that is more objective, or at least that's perceived to be more objective. Because if you have a complex issue like climate change or genetically modified organisms, there are many dimensions to the problem. It isn't simply a matter of expertise in one particular area, like atmospheric chemistry. But if we think of climate change, we need to understand atmospheric chemistry. We need to understand ice dynamics. We need to understand ocean heat uptake. And in order to really answer a complex question in its full range of issues, you really can't do that with just one person. And so the assessment becomes a way to bring together the diverse expertise that's relevant to the question, so to look at the question in all of its complexity, and then also to try to aim for a degree of objectivity by not relying on the opinion of just one or two or three people, but getting as many voices, as many relevant voices as possible into the room.
Naomi Oreskes, the name of your book is Discerning Experts, but you have kind of a nickname for this project, which I love, Assessing Assessments.
Right,
a panel of experts looking at how assessments actually work. And you looked specifically, primarily at three different assessments, one looking at acid rain, one looking at ozone, and then one kind of a subset of the overall climate assessments that we get. And that's specifically looking at the state of the West Antarctic ice sheet. Those are the three modern assessments that you really focused your attention on. But you also kind of make some comparisons to a very early assessment panel going back to the mid-1800s, a British panel of experts that were asked to weigh in on the safety of vaccines, which sounds incredibly relevant still today.
Yes.
One of the interesting things that you point out about that assessment compared to modern assessments is that they actually published a dissenting opinion along with kind of the majority opinion. It sounds more like a Supreme Court decision than a modern scientific assessment, where the goal is typically to find consensus. Where did the idea of consensus as the goal come from? When did that arise?
Well, again, this is a very interesting question. One of the things we see in our work is that the idea of consensus as a goal is a relatively recent phenomenon. We begin to see the word being used more extensively again after World War II. So it seems to be coupled with the rise of large-scale assessments, where you now say it's not enough simply to ask an expert, Heather Goldstone, her opinion. We need to really canvass the full range of scientific opinion. And once you have that, then invariably you're grappling with the issue of scientific disagreement or differences of opinion about how you interpret data. And so out of this idea begins to emerge, or this sort of kind of a consensus about consensus, if you will. Scientists begin to have the view that it's extremely important for them to speak in a single voice, to be univocal, because if they don't, the fear is that this will give the impression that they don't really know what they're talking about, or it will be used or abused by people who want to exploit those differences of opinion. While it's totally understandable, we want to argue that this might actually not be the best approach for two reasons. One is the one that you just alluded to. There is always disagreement in science. It's not realistic to think that scientists will always agree 100% about everything. And the other reason why it's really important is that when people feel they have to come to consensus, it leads to what we would call a least common denominator result. That is to say, I'm in a room with a complex group of people with a lot of different opinions. If we can only say what we all agree upon, then what we all agree upon is going to tend to be somewhat limited. Our results may tend to be a bit downplayed. They may be a bit sort of vanilla, to use a metaphor. And we've seen this in the IPCC reports, where there's been a consistent pattern of the reports actually being weak relative to what the scientific evidence was later shown to be true. So we know that a lot of climate change deniers have accused the IPCC of being alarmist, but we have actually shown that the opposite is true. They've actually been extremely conservative.
So, Naomi Oreskes, as you make this argument that perhaps consensus shouldn't be the overarching goal of scientific assessments, what should be the goal? What's the alternative?
Well, I think two things. First of all, if there is consensus, like if there's genuine consensus about certain issues, and almost invariably there is consensus about some things, that should absolutely be articulated. It's extremely important for the public and policymakers to know what it is that scientists are confident they know. And I think one of the problems we've had in the past is there's been a kind of muddling of things that are really quite certain scientifically with other things that are less certain. And the public doesn't always have a clear sense where those boundaries lie. So I think the clear articulation of consensus on settled science is an extremely important role that assessments play. And I think scientists should absolutely continue to do that. In addition, when there are areas where consensus has not yet emerged, and I view consensus not so much as a goal, but as an emergent property. It's something that does over time emerge, in a sense, on its own accord. In areas where that hasn't yet happened, then I think it's extremely important for the scientific community to be clear. And that could mean doing the sort of thing that the 19th Century Vaccine Commission did, which is to say the vast majority of us agree that this is the situation, A, B, C, and D. However, there's a minority that feels otherwise, and we're going to explain that minority view because, you know, it's important for people to be clear about the limits of our knowledge, and because, you know, who knows, maybe they're right. And I think that kind of honesty and transparency would actually help to build the credibility of the scientific community. Because one thing that happens, and I've spoken to scientists who have said this as well, sometimes scientists are afraid that if they express dissent in public, it's like airing your dirty laundry, and that it will actually confuse the public and undermine public confidence. But I think the evidence actually goes the other way, that when people are honest about what they know and what they don't know, that builds confidence, because the public will feel, okay, these scientists aren't trying to pull the wool over us. They're honest about the limits of their knowledge, but here are the things they tell us that they do know. And because they're honest about the limits of their knowledge, we can be confident about the things that they're confident about.
After spending a lot of time looking at what goes on in the process of creating assessments and what they turn out, are you more convinced that this is an important part of the scientific process at this point, or do you have a diminished sense of the importance and the effectiveness of these scientific assessments?
Definitely more convinced. This was a big question for us in our research group, and when we started this project, we had some pretty strong differences of opinion among ourselves about this issue. And I tended to view assessments more as a kind of summary of existing knowledge that didn't produce new information, and that therefore in some ways could be viewed as a bit of a drain on the scientific community. But I have to say, I changed my views. So this is science working as it should. We got new evidence. And I was persuaded by my colleagues and by the data that actually it's more than just a summary. The process of integrating information from many different areas of science yields new insights. There's a kind of whole is greater than the sum of its parts aspect. You know, there's a reason we talk about synthesis, right? That synthesis creates something. We synthesize something. We don't just summarize it. You know, in chemistry, a synthesis produces a new thing. And I think we see that here.
Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science at Harvard University and co-author of Discerning Experts, The Practice of Scientific Assessment for Environmental Policy. Naomi, thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.